or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this March 18th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. It's my pleasure to welcome novelists Peter Heller to the show this morning. Peter is on with me now. Rebecca Sherm will be on with her debut novel that has been compared to The Girl on the Train. She will join me in the second half of the show. I love it on mornings when I'm smart enough to put two writers together whose books are very synergistic. So this morning we have characters who are on the run, characters who have committed crimes. Peter and Rebecca are very different people, but and their books are very different. But there's a wonderful synergy, mystery element between both of them. Their characters are incredibly compelling. I think you're going to really enjoy this. Peter Heller is the best-selling author of The Dog Stars. He holds an MFA from the Iowa Writers Workshop in both fiction and poetry. An award-winning adventure writing and longtime contributor to NPR, Peter is the contributing editor at Outside Magazine, Men's Journal, and National Geographic Adventure, and a regular contributor to Bloomberg Businessweek. He's also the author of several nonfiction books, including Kook, The Whale Warriors, and Heller High Water, Surviving Tibet's Tsangpo River. But it's his latest novel, The Painter, published by Knopf, that we will be chatting about this morning. Peter, hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. So nobody tells about their novel better than the novelist. So I'm going to let you talk a little bit about The Painter, what inspired it. Tell us a little bit about Jim Stegner and take us into your world a little.
Great. Well, let's see. The novel is about a painter, an expressionist painter from Taos, New Mexico, who is pretty famous, is painting himself for a lot of money in his gallery in Santa Fe. He comes from this sort of rough-and-tumble, brawling school of painters that did come up through Taos in the 70s, 80s. They spent a lot of time in jail. They were lovers and drinkers and fighters. So he's that kind of painter. He suffers a tragedy, and I won't spoil it and tell you what it is, but it's about as bad as it gets. And then his marriage falls apart, and he moves up to a valley in western Colorado to try and get his life back together. It's a really beautiful valley. It exists. It's called the North Fork of the Gunnison. And it's kind of a riverwind run of cottonwoods and organic farms and ranches all surrounded by mountains. And he begins to paint again. He finds a model he can work with, a feisty young woman who understands art. She is a painter herself. And he begins to sell his paintings, get his life back together. He's a fly fisherman. He finds a creek that he loves to fish, which is important to him. And one evening in late August, just before archery season, bow hunting season in Colorado, he's driving up his favorite creek. It's just a dirt road, the stream, woody canyon, spruce and fir, and mountains upstream. And there's a horse trailer blocking the road, and this outfitter, this hunting guide, is trying to load a little strawberry roan, and she's balking and refusing to load. And this guy gets frustrated, and he pulls out a club, and he starts to beat her to death. And our hero, Jim Stegner, he intervenes, and he basically kills the guy and saves the horse. And he doesn't kill him right then, but soon after. And the whole novel is about what happens to his work and his life after this murder. And it's all organized around the painting so that every chapter, every section begins with a catalog resume of a painting. It'll say sort of horse and crow, oil on linen, 20 by 30 inches, collection of the artist. And so you follow the story, the narrative through his paintings and his work. And that's pretty much it. he is a real guy. We can talk about that. There's a little overlap with nonfiction in this book, so we can talk a little bit about that, how that happened.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about that, because I'm becoming more and more convinced that it's really difficult to write anything, fiction, nonfiction. I don't write poetry, but without the voice in place. And, you know, maybe you don't know what's going to happen in a book or something about the character, but the voice is essential. And if you can't hear the character's voice, it's very difficult. So, yeah, let's talk about that. Let's talk about getting Jim's voice, where he came from, and the nonfiction elements of the book.
Yeah, so you put your finger right on it, I think. I think, you know, for me, it is all about voice, and it's about the music and the language. When I wrote The Dog Stars, I just began with the first line, and I had no clue what I was writing. And, you know, I didn't know if that was allowed, because this is my first, Dog Stars was my first novel. And I'd written all this nonfiction, and these are about expeditions, these are about environmental campaigns and stuff, and I always knew what was going to happen next. I knew what the ending was going to be. When I sat down to finally write fiction, which I'd wanted to do since I was like 11, I didn't want to know what was going to happen next. And so
the line that it started with? The Dog Stars,
Dog Stars was, I keep the beast running, I keep the 100 low lead on tap, I foresee attacks. And then a few lines later, my name is Hig, one name, Big Hig if you need another. If I ever woke up crying in the middle of a dream, and I'm not saying I did, it's because the trout are gone, everyone. And, you know, as soon as I had that voice, I was transfixed, and I just thought, you know, okay, I'm listening, keep telling. And he did, and it was so wonderful. It was as if the sky was sitting on the other side of a campfire, you know, on an October night with the flames blowing around and telling me what happened to him a few years before. But before I started it, I didn't know, it was my first fiction, and I didn't know, you know, if you could start with a first line, if you could have success that way. So I called, my best friend in high school is Carlton Cuse, and he was the showrunner for Lost and the executive producer, that, you know, TV show that had like 8 subplots running all the time.
right.
And he's worked with a lot of novelists. So I called him up and I said, hey, have you ever worked with a novelist who just starts with the first line and has no clue, like literally no clue what's going on? And he didn't even hesitate. He said, yeah, you know, I've worked with Stephen King. He often starts with the first line, has no idea. It's a voice. As you said, the voice is a character. The character's in a place. There's a situation, because there's always a situation, and he writes into the story. And then he said something that really surprised me. He said, Elmore Leonard, I've worked with him, and he often starts with the first line. And I thought that was so interesting, because these two guys are so, you know, you think of them as having such tightly plotted, fast-paced books. And it gave me permission. I figured those guys must start that way and then pull back and plot and stuff. But it gave me the permission to start. So I wrote The Dog Stars that way. When I finished The Dog Stars, I thought, okay, I want to, you know, sophomore effort, second novel syndrome, don't need any of that. Let's get started on the second one and have it mostly done by the time the first one comes out. So that was the idea. And I sat down and I got this voice and I began writing, and I soon realized, you know, it's a painter and he's in Colorado and he's suffering sort of the aftermath of some big losses, and he's tough. His voice was tough. And after a few days writing it, I sort of thought, wow, this sounds a lot like my friend Jim Wagner, who is an expressionist artist in Taos and was my fishing friend for 10 years in Paonia, where the novel begins. So I thought, it's not him. I decided there's no way, because the liability issues would be too difficult. I just kept going. And about 3 weeks later, I thought, this really is Jim Wagner. I've got to call him. You know, I can't write this book without his okay. So I sort of anxiously picked up the phone. I called him. I said, hey, Jim, I'm writing about an expressionist painter in Taos. And he said, wow, that sounds great. And I said, yeah, and he shot a guy in a bar just like you did. a guy who made a comment about his kid, and he spent a year in Santa Fe State, just like you. And there was kind of a pause, and I said, and he loves to fly fish, just like you, and they call him Hemingway down at the river, just like you, and he kind of wears his hat cocked on his head with the flies stuck in it, and his clothes are paint spattered, just like you, and he kind of looks like you. You know, he's tall and broad-shouldered, and he has a salt and pepper beard, and his voice sounds like yours, and I kind of went on. I said, yeah, and his palette actually is really similar to yours, and his paintings are strikingly, you know, alike, the subjects. And in fact, the painting that you did called The Continuing Housing Crisis, you know, that one with the fish and swallowing all those houses, I put that in yesterday, and then I stopped, and there was a long pause, and then he said, wow, that sounds awesome. You know, that sounds great. Let me know how it goes. So big relief. And when I finished the book, I sent him the first, you know, we get like two hardbacks when the book first comes out and in the mail from the publisher. And I sent him one, FedExed it right away. And a few days later, I got a phone call. I was on my tour and I looked down and it said Jim Wagner on the phone. And I picked it up and I was a little bit, you know, nervous about it. And he said, man, I just read the book cover to cover. I love it. I'm walking around my house wondering if I killed a guy. So I thought I'd done my job.
Indeed. Yeah, I wonder if that, in some ways it seems like it makes it easier to base it on somebody because, you know, you have all these great details that you can use. But at some point you have to jump off and make this character his own person and not this guy. And I was wondering if that process was more difficult or easier because you had this guy in the back of your head.
No, I think it was sort of seamless that way. I mean, the character was fully realized on the page. I mean, you know, he was Jim Wagner and he wasn't, and he really was Jim Stegner, his own guy, and he was doing stuff that Jim Wagner would never do, and he was off and running. Yeah, I couldn't really contain him once he got going. So
I was going to say, what surprised you the most about him, and what surprised Jim, the real Jim Wagner, the most about him, the most about the character?
That's interesting. I think the most surprising, I mean, for me, I think the most thrilling and surprising piece of writing this novel was every time my character approached the canvas, because he paints a lot in the book, and like Jim Wagner, Jim Stegner is very prolific, and he paints fast, and when he approaches a canvas, and when he did in the book, I never knew what he was going to paint, and so it was so thrilling and fun and sometimes shocking to see, you know, what happened when he began to work. And when the paintings were finished, I was always, it was thrilling because they somehow, I mean, they were their own works of art. They seemed separate from me, and Jim himself sort of channeled them, and they always addressed what was going on in the book in a very interesting way. I mean, what was going on in the painting, and they were poetic in some way. They threw light onto what he was going through in ways that surprised me, and so that was always really, really fun.
I like that. My guest this morning is Peter Heller. The book is The Painter, and you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. This might be a good time for you to read a passage to us, as long as we're on the subject of art, which I want to get a little bit more into. But if you can, just take a moment to read to us a little bit and take us into this guy's art life.
Sure. So Jim, as I said, you know, he paints a lot in the book, and he muses a lot about art. And at one point he says, nobody, not even artists, understood art, what speed has to do with it, how much work it takes year after year, building the skills, the trust in the process, more work probably than any Olympic athlete ever puts in because it is 24 hours a day, even in dreams. And then when the skills and the trust are in place, the best work usually takes the least effort, usually. It comes fast. It comes without thought. It comes like a horse running you over at night. But even if people understand this, they don't understand that sometimes it is not like that at all. Because the process has always been craft, years and years, then faith, then letting go. But now sometimes the best work is agony, pieces put together, torn apart, rebuilt, doubt in everything that has been learned, terrible crisis of faith, the faith that allowed it all to work. Oh, God. And even then, through this, if you survive the halting pace and the fever, sometimes you make the best work you've ever made. That is the part none of us understand. The reason people are so moved by art and why artists tend to take it all so seriously is that if they are real and true, they come to the painting with everything they know and feel and love and all the things they don't know and some of the things they hope, and they are honest about them all and put them on the canvas. What can be more serious? What more really can be at stake except life itself, which is why maybe artists are always equating the two and driving everybody crazy by insisting that art is life. Well, cut us some slack. It's harder work than one might imagine and riskier and takes a very special and dear kind of mad person.
Hmm. That was Peter Heller reading from his book, The Painter. I have a friend who's a visual artist, a painter, and we always have these conversations about the similarities. There's so many similarities between the visual arts and the written arts. And, you know, we kind of talk about all these parallels of what we're trying to get at through craft. And I was wondering if in living through a different artistic medium of living in this guy's painter life, if it shed any light on your writing life and if you were able to draw any comparisons or contrasts in art.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think the only reason I could write with authority, it seems, about painting is because I'm a writer. And I don't paint, but I grew up with a lot of painters. My mom painted, my dad's mother was a wonderful painter, my uncles. So, and then Jim Wagner himself, you know, being around him for 10 years, watching him work. I think there are similarities. I mean, as I said, you know, Jim Wagner, as I watched him, when he approached the canvas, he never knew what was going to happen. And it was a very physical act for him. It was rhythmic. It was, I don't want to say dance-like, but there was a music when I watched him paint, there was a certain music to the way he moved. And I like to think of writing the same way. You know, when I sit down, I like not to know what's going to happen. I like to follow the music of the language. And, you know, in an odd way, writing feels very physical to me, too, when I do it. And I am physically exhausted when I'm done with a session. So, you know, that's interesting to me. I think that I know that writers all have different methods. I mean, I think there's probably as many ways to write a novel, for instance, as there are novelists. And my method in writing The Painter was very different than in writing The Dog Star. So even there, every novel may have a different method. But I love not to know what's going to happen. And I love to let my character, my voice, or the language just free associate. And I love to work fast. I kind of believe in speed and momentum. And I watched that happen when Jim painted. And so, so I think that's, you know, even though I don't paint, I think that there was a lot of sympathy between the two kinds of art.
One last point on that is, I can't remember who I was talking to, but we were talking about how much work occupies your life. You know, in an individual's life, work takes up, I don't know, you know, 60% or 50% of your waking day, and how hard it is to write about work. And and what I loved about this is that you could get in his mind about his work, which is something that's so important in everyday life and something that we so rarely write about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what my question is exactly. It's more of an observation. But I liked reading about people at work.
He was very self-reflective about it. One thing I can say about that I really admire that I don't do, so watching Jim Wagner, the real painter, paint, is how he integrated his work into his life. I thought it was so wonderful. I would go over there. We'd, you know, say make a date to go fishing. And I'd go to meet him, and he'd be in the studio, and he'd be, you know, painting away, you know, with real swiftness. And he'd put his tools down and say, come on in, you know, you hungry, and then let's have a cigar. He'd step outside, he'd give me a little cheroot, and we'd smoke one of these little vanilla-flavored cheroots that he loved to smoke. And then he would put together some sort of meal of roast chilies and eggs or whatever. He's a marvelous cook. He'd say, just a second, and we go in and maybe watch 20 minutes of a reality cop show, one of those chase shows. He loved those. Then go fishing, then come back and maybe have something else to eat, and then he would start painting again, and he might paint for, you know, half an hour or 2 hours or four. Put that down, go into the garage, start working on some sculpture, and it was all sort of, there was never this sort of self-conscious, you know, I'm going to work now. It was all integrated so beautifully into an entire day, there was a wholeness to his life that was so neat to me. And, you know, I get up in the morning, I'm like, okay, I'm going to go write I write 1,000 words a day. I'm going to go do that now. I'm going to work. And I love the way art just became, you know, sort of just this wonderful sort of this thread that he wove through his entire day.
Like the dance that you were talking about earlier. Yeah, he's sort of dancing with his work. Yeah, that's neat. That's neat. I was wondering if you, as you look across the arc of your work, both of the novels and even your nonfiction and journalism stuff, if you look at kind of the body of it, I'm wondering what the big questions are that hold interest to you, what the unifying thread is through all of this, and what you're grappling with, what you keep coming back to.
I think for me, it's about how we stay connected to the things that we love through our lives, which inevitably include terrible loss. And I think, you know, that's what I'm, as I look back at the last two novels, that's what I'm sort of, I'm finding, you know, and as I address, you know, the next novel, I find that that's the theme that really interests me. It's, you know, it seems like losing things is what, one of the things as human beings that we're best at. You know, we begin to lose things from the moment we're born, and we end up losing everything most important to us through our lives. Parents and spouse, sometimes, you know, inevitably spouses if they go before us, and lovers and work and abilities as we get older. We lose our bodies piece by piece, and it's just for self-aware, emotional, spiritual beings, it seems to me a great challenge. And you know, how through that we stay connected, and how we keep our joy in our lives. And I think that's what I'm thinking about most.
And you're such a great landscape writer. You seem so connected. I know in your outside of your writing life, you're so connected to the landscape and all of these adventurous runs. And translating that also onto the page, you're so wonderful at that. Can you talk a little bit about setting and landscape and incorporating that into your work and getting it right?
Yeah, I think a sense of place is very, very important. I learned early on when I did a lot, you know, as you mentioned, I've written a lot for magazines, and I did a lot of expedition stories. I was an expedition kayaker, and I loved to be on rivers and in wild places. And I found that the most important thing in terms of, you know, hooking a reader, getting a reader to be interested in the story, was establishing a sense of place right away. And a sense of place that someone could hear and feel and smell, and so that the reader felt grounded and oriented. And then I found that once you gave a reader that, you could sort of take their hand and lead them into your landscape, and you could pretty much take them anywhere. And so even as I did, you know, even so, say, writing for Business Week, when I'm writing more, you know, business-oriented features, I still try and give the reader a sense of place through their senses at the beginning. And I think we're very, you know, we're spatially oriented. We trust our senses more than we trust our brain, you know, our thought processes, our minds. So I believe if you can awaken a landscape, a place, through a reader's senses, I think that they will trust you in a way that is never possible if you're just sort of telling them what's going on.
Yeah, right, right. My guest this morning is Peter Heller. The book is The Painter. We're drawing down on our time. But I also want to talk a little bit about minor characters. There's so many wonderful minor characters in here. And how much you felt like you needed to get to know them, get inside their heads and their motivations, and a little bit about the characters who aren't as much on the page, but who I imagine have full, rich lives inside of your brain as well.
Yeah, you know, so the minor characters are some of my favorites. I've just loved, you know, when Wheezy, the cop in Santa Fe, you know, he's very overweight, you know, he's popping these antacid pills all the time. Can't drink a Coke. He has this very wry sense of humor and a real respect for Jim Wagner, the painter, as a person, but he wants to pin this murder on him. And they have this great relationship. I just love the relationship because there's a lot of mutual respect. And, you know, Wheezy has his number. He gets why he was triggered and, you know, had to save this helpless horse. And I love watching their relationship unfold. I actually, Jim's nemesis in the novel, this guy Jason, he's a trucker, he's a hunter, he's a fisherman, he's a really tough dude who came up in a very tough upbringing in Western Colorado. This guy, to me, is, you know, I love this character. I have huge respect for him. And again, you know, he ends up, I think, in respecting Jim in some way, and Jim, and it's reciprocated. So it's fun watching all these characters, you know, sort of dance around each other. They're all trying to get each other,
right? Right.
And the stakes are high. You know, the stakes are life and death. But I just, yeah, they're just great. They all have their own voices. They have their own lives. And they're very intriguing to me, and they're so fun. I mean, when they come, you know, when they waltz into the novel, I just get so happy.
Do you feel done with this world? Are there characters that keep talking to you to say, you know, what about me? What about a book about me? Or do you feel like this book has been put to bed and you're satisfied with it, and, you know, there's nothing here that you're going to revisit in the future?
You know, you just never know because, you know, it's where the dog starts. I left Hig out sleeping under the stars, and if he starts talking again, you know, then I'll have to write down what he says. I've got my orders. Same with Jim Wagner, but Jim Stegner. See, I'm already confusing the real me. But for now, no, I'm moving on. I'm into another novel. It's completely different, and I won't talk about it because it's just sort of in the middle of it. But yeah, it's nice to have these lives that, you know, are continuing on in a parallel universe, and you kind of wish them well.
Right, right. Any last minute words of advice for writers, new writers, journalists, nonfiction?
Yes. There's one thing that I discovered that has changed my writing life. I heard that Graham Greene wrote 500 words a day every day, kept a subtotal, stopped at word 500 in the middle of a sentence, in the middle of a dialogue, in the middle of a scene. What I realized when I read that was that he was stopping in the middle, and I didn't do that, and none of the author friends that I know do that. We write our however many hours a day or however many words, and we always wrote through the scene or the thought. And then if you think about it, that's a transition. That's double return, white space. You come back to white page. You might as well start the book over again every day. Very tough. So I sort of adapted that method, and now, I write 1,000 words a day, but I always continue on until I'm right in the middle of the most exciting, you know, scene. And then I stop. And I make myself stop. I don't, you know, write on. I could write twice as much probably sometimes, but I don't. I make myself stop after 1,000 words in the middle of the scene, and then I cannot wait to get up again in the morning and keep going. And I got so excited about it, I began to kind of proselytize. And now all my author friends do the same thing, and it's kind of changed our lives.
That is fantastic. I haven't heard that advice. I love that. I love that.
Yeah, it's neat.
This was a treat. Peter Heller, thank you so much for taking the time this morning. This was wonderful.
Oh, thanks for having me, Marie. It's really great to be here.
Tell us real quick where we find you. I know you have a great website because I sat on it a lot all week. But tell us where we can find you.
It's peterheller.net. And net like a fishing net, if you forget.
Perfect.
Yep.
Wonderful, wonderful. Peter, thanks so much for taking the time.
All right. Have a great day. See ya.
That was Peter Heller. The book is The Painter. It's out and available now. We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Rebecca Sherm will be on for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast. We are on iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads. There's information on past shows, upcoming shows, all that stuff. We are on Facebook, Writers on Writing, KUCI FM. We are on Twitter. We are on Stitcher. We're all over the place. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Rebecca Sherm is the author of Unbecoming, a novel. She received her MFA from the University of Michigan, where she was a postgraduate Zell Fellow. She lives in Michigan, where she's working on her second novel, Beta. It's my pleasure to welcome her on this morning. Rebecca, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So tell us, I was saying at the very top of the hour that that I was brilliant in putting you and Peter Heller together, because your characters are totally different from one another, but they're both kind of on the run. They're both running from crimes. They're different, but they're both wonderful, and they have this wonderful synergy between them. So I want to, for those who have not yet picked up Unbecoming, I want to let you talk a little bit about it, talk about Grace and kind of where she came from, and tell us about the novel.
Sure. Well, Unbecoming is about the making of a femme fatale. I wanted to investigate sort of this flat type of the femme fatale that I grew up reading in noir fiction, but as a real person, as a real complicated flesh-and-blood woman, how she got that way and the full psychological underbelly. So it's about her transformation from this little girl who's tragically anxious to please into a very complicated criminal. She and her childhood sweetheart plan a heist with his friends, and they're caught, but she gets away. I'm not giving away too much because the book sort of opens with this information.
Right.
And so it's in some ways, it's about the story of how a heist comes to be and the dirty and lonely aftermath of a failed heist. And it's also a love story, or really three love stories, none of them straightforward, and a character study about creating identity and dismantling identity, how we think about love, theft, honesty, deception, and all of the really ugly intersections between those ideas.
That's great. I said this to you on the phone before. I never do this, but I was thinking maybe we will start with your reading so that we can get into the voice. The book has such a wonderful, compelling beginning that I'd love for our listeners to hear that first. Can you do just a little reading from it?
Oh, sure. Of course. Okay. Chapter one. The first lie Grace had told Hannah was her name. Bonjour, je m'appelle Julie, Grace had said. She'd been in Paris for only a month, and her French was still new and stiff. She'd chosen the name Julie because it was sweet and easy on the French tongue, much more so than Grace was. The best lies were the simplest and made the most sense, in the mind and in the mouth. These lies were the easiest to swallow. Jacqueline, her boss, had shown Grace to her work table, abutting Hannah's, and where to store her tools in the jars along the center crack, what she could borrow and what she would need to procure herself. Hannah had reached out to cover a jar of picks and pliers. I don't share these, she'd said with a taut smile, like someone forced to apologize. When Grace sat down on her spinning stool a few minutes later, Hannah asked where she was from. Grace was so obviously American. California, Grace said, because most people already had ideas about California. They didn't ask you to explain it to them. Grace hated lying, got no joy from it, and this was how she knew she wasn't pathological. But California satisfied people so easily, even in Paris. Garland, Tennessee, where Grace was really from, was a confusing answer that only led to more questions. Tennessee, Hannah might have started. Elvis? Pequeno? Hillbillies? When Grace had lived in New York, everyone who asked her where she was from followed her answer with the same question. What's that like? As if her journey from somewhere as tiny and undistinguished as Garland had required a laborious transformation, as if getting from Garland to New York City had been some kind of pilgrimage to the first world. Grace had been in Paris for 2 years now, and she had been Julie from California since her arrival. Her life was conducted entirely in French, another kind of disguise. She and Hannah seldom discussed anything deep in the past, and when the conversation took an unwelcome turn, They quickly righted themselves. Facing each other across their tables, they hunched over their antiques and talked of busted hinges and gouged veneer. Not sorrow or worry. Not home. And the boys would be paroled tomorrow, released from Lacombe and sent home to Garland with their families. It was 3 o'clock in Paris now, morning in Tennessee. Riley and Alves would be eating their last breakfast of powdered eggs and sausage patties, doughy-faced guards planted behind them. Grace had always imagined them together, but she'd begun to imagine their lives without her so long ago that she often forgot how little she really knew. She didn't know a thing about their lives anymore. She hadn't spoken to them in more than 3 years, since before they were arrested for robbing the Wynn House. 3 years of imagined sausage breakfast. He wouldn't come for her, she told herself. It had been too long. Grace had often felt like two people, always at odds, but when the boys had gone to prison, one Grace had stopped her life's clock. Now it had begun to tick again. She had no control of Riley now, what he would do or where he would go, and these unknowns bred in her a private, shapeless dread. She'd left lies unleashed in Garland, and now she couldn't mind them.
I love it. That is Rebecca Sherm reading from her debut novel, Unbecoming. I love this idea of starting a novel knowing that the character is unreliable, knowing that the character is going to set out to tell you lies or that is already lying. And
yeah.
Then you kind of get, you know, glimpses into, okay, I'm getting some of the truth because she's sharing some things with me, but we know this character is a liar. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about writing unreliable narrators, because I think, well, you can speak to this, but I think it's important for writers not to judge their characters so that we have empathy for them, but navigating difficult, prickly characters who we, you know, are still rooting for.
Right. I mean, this was the central psychological project of this novel to me, is that I wanted to understand someone who seemed at first to be completely beyond my own understanding, someone so completely different from me. And I was really interested in liars. I mean, we all have these people in our lives or have encountered them who just lie in my line, and they don't need to, you know, it's just become a crutch or a habit. And I was trying to understand that behavior, as well as develop this idea of how the femme fatale got to be that way. And there are lots of other ideas that we can talk about or that I was developing with this character. But as a novelist and as a reader of fiction, too, for me, the whole point is to try to understand people that are beyond understanding, to zip on someone else's human suit. And with Grace, it was both the great trial of writing this book and its greatest satisfaction to force myself into her mind every day and try to empathize with someone like her. Try to understand how she made all these decisions that made her this way.
Yeah, I love the line about, I know I'm not a psychopath because I don't really enjoy lying. And, you know,
yeah.
I'm forced into doing it.
Yeah, well, something I learned early on when I was working on this novel and I was doing all kinds of research, but, you know, one strain of research was psychological research about lying. And I learned that, you know, we throw around this term pathological liars, but pathological liars don't even know they're lying. They're not lying to get ahead, really. Grace is not pathological, and the liars that we think of in our lives as, you know, troubling, who make trouble for us, they know they're doing it, you know, and that's what makes it so confounding.
Right, right. What were the big surprises and reveals of this character to you that you couldn't have guessed when you sat down to write her, that she, you know, somehow revealed to you that sort of shocked you?
Well, for me, that journey was trying to locate the sort of center of the pain. You know, every character and every person has some sort of pain center, you know, and some people are very upfront about what it is, and some people you never know, you never find out. But when I'm writing a character, you want to know what they want and what they fear. And with a character like Grace, who is so reluctant to confess or to tell the truth about herself, sort of crawling around her psyche and trying to find the center of that pain was a long and difficult process. And when I found it in this conversation between her and between Grace and Riley's mother, Mrs. Graham, and I wrote this conversation where Mrs. Graham confronts Grace about a missing envelope of money. And I was very shaken by my own experience of writing that scene. It really messed me up for a few days. I had to take a lot of walked around the block and was, you know, smelling flowers and trying to get back in the real world. But a reveal like that with a character is like having a reveal with a dear friend or something, where the world looks totally different after you understand something about someone that you didn't before.
Right. It has to be true that the characters are not you, but they all are you because you're unlocking different, you know, they're all coming from you. And so unlocking these different parts of yourself that aren't you, I'm not saying this very articulately, that's an interesting self-discovery process as well of, you know, I didn't know this, you know, little nugget existed in some neuron of my brain would be, you know, kind of an interesting reveal as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think that what you're describing is, I think it's the hardest thing for a writer to describe, especially to non-writers. When I'm talking with family and friends about these characters and, you know, they aren't autobiographical, but I made them up. So I have to take some responsibility for them, you know. It's very hard to try to draw this distinction. I was talking with my husband's family the other night, was saying, well, I mean, I'm not a jewel thief, but I had to figure out what it would be like to be a jewel thief. And in a way, that sort of makes you a jewel thief temporarily.
Right.
It's very hard to navigate that. Yes.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I was listening to an interview. I think it was Kevin Spacey. Anyway, he was talking about Meryl Streep's acting method. And she has said she has to know a secret about her character that only she knows, a secret that isn't on the page and it isn't going to be on the screen, but it's something that she knows about the character that is never revealed to make her fully inhabit that person in a more authentic and unique way. And I was wondering if that is your experience as well. This woman is carrying so many secrets, but if there were, and obviously, you know, a lot more about her just from, you know, living with her for years, and not all of that can make it onto the page. But if you feel that there is something about her that you know that we still don't know, that brought her to life for you.
Well, and I think that she does tell the reader as best she can what that secret is, a little bit throughout the book, and then we feel it with a big wallop at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's really just about her relationship with Mrs. Graham.
Mm-hmm.
And that was such a surprise, and so important, and it was absolutely a discovery. I had no idea when I set out to write the novel that was going to become so important to the character or to me or to the engine of the narrative. But what happens to me usually, I mean, things are going well when I'm writing, and what happened with this book is that you're writing to find this stuff out. And then once you do, you have to rewrite the whole thing knowing with your new information.
Right.
So I don't think I learned that until I was probably three drafts into this book.
Wow.
And then, you know, I had to go and rewrite the whole thing with this new incredible piece of information that I had.
Right.
Yeah.
I did want to mention to our listeners who are mostly writers themselves, a lot of them are writers themselves, that if you go onto, you did a great interview on fictionwritersreview.com.
And
it's a wonderful interview. And you have a snapshot, a physical picture of your outline for this book, which looks very complicated and daunting. And I know you said you did it in pencil because it kept changing.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about keeping the wealth of information on all of the levels organized and sort of how you went about that.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, this book is so it's so densely sort of thematically plotted. Everything that happens is sometimes I think that I did myself a disservice by making that as an outline when what I really should have done was drawn some kind of web.
Right.
But what I ended up having to do and what helped me a great deal is I would code information. And it became a way of editing myself, saying, well, if this scene is important, what is it connected to? Why is it important? And so I would have these little codes out to the side that would say, you know, class discontent or this or early habits of lying or theft or sex or parental love. And I sort of had this little roster of connections that I was trying to make. And if a scene wasn't the scene wasn't meaningfully connected to any of those things, and it didn't belong in the story. It may well belong in the characters' lives, of course, but, you know, a book isn't really a story of a character's lives. It's the story of this thread in their lives. Mm-hmm. And so that coding of information ended up being really helpful for me. But, yeah, I developed that outline and really relied on it until about the two-thirds or three-quarter mark of the book, when the past catches up with the present, and I didn't know what would happen after that, so I couldn't outline it. And then when I actually got to that point in the narrative where the past caught up in the present, I didn't need the outline anymore. I knew. I was just trying to keep up mm-hmm. with the characters. But I saved that outline in part to remind myself when I started my second novel that this is really hard, and it's going to be a big mess, and it's going to bring you to your knees, and you're going to shake your fist at the heavens and say, this will never work. I've made a terrible mistake. But that outline reminds me that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. Like, I can clean up this mess.
Yeah, I wondered if having gone through this process, if it calms you down the second time of saying, okay, I know, you know, I'm just going to surrender myself to the process and know that this is going to work out, or if having been through it, was so daunting, you're like, oh gosh, not again.
I'm very happy to tell you it's the first one. Most days, let's say 3 out of 4 days is the first one. And on the fourth day, it's the second one.
Right.
You know, I had talked to a lot of friends who were working on their second novel at the time about whether or not writing a first novel teaches you to write your second, and I was really disheartened by how many people said, no, it doesn't. You're always sort of writing your first novel. But I understand now what they mean by that. I mean, you're not going to write the same one again. It's always going to feel like it's the first one. But the difference is that you have this proof that you can do it.
Right.
You have this hard proof that no one can take away from you, that you can do it. And I just have to keep believing, you know, if I did it once before, I can do it again. Right.
Right.
The whole thing might work differently, but I have to have faith in that way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. My guest this morning is Rebecca Shurm. The book is Unbecoming. It is her debut novel. And you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Without giving anything away of the ending, of course, but you mentioned endings, and I read something that struck me as very helpful to writers, which is you get to the end of a book and you think you have these two choices, and you have to realize you have way more than two choices. And,
right.
You know, maybe you should, as you put it, overturn the chessboard.
Right.
And try something totally different. And without giving anything specific away about the novel, I wonder if you could kind of unpack that idea for us a little bit, because I think it's a brilliant one.
Yeah, well, I can't take credit for that idea. That came from a teacher of mine, Eileen Pollock. She's a wonderful writer and novelist, but she's the one who first said overturn the chessboard. And it became really important to know not just that there are more than two or three choices, but that those two or three choices that you see are probably all the wrong choices. They're the ones that are the most obvious, and they're the ones that you sort of need to eliminate right away. Because if those were the easy choices, then you didn't need to write this book. You're trying to get somewhere. You're trying to get to a remote island, you know. You're not trying to just drive down the highway. And you need to discount those easy destinations right away. And I thought a lot with this book about how it should end, because this book is not really a heist novel. And, you know, it's not really a thriller, but it's sort of talking to heist novels and talking to thrillers. It's sort of about those kinds of ideas in those books, and the characters are thinking about them all the time. And those have certain conventions. And how do you write a book that's about heists and thieves and not end it any of the ways that we're sort of trained to want those stories to end? And for me, it comes back to what the character, that character's secret, what the character cares about that is the hardest thing for that character to express. Maybe a good ending for a book in general is to remind the reader that this character is a deeply human person with dark rooms in their psyche that we're not always invited into, you know. A novel's plot trains us to expect certain things, but human beings don't really work like that. And I think maybe the best thing a novel can do is take you away from the plot expectations and back into just sort of that experience of being human and being led into the darker rooms of your brain.
Right, right. Yeah, that you raise an interesting point, because I was reading somebody's very articulate review of this, and they said, you know, the marketing campaigns kind of did more harm to your book than good, in her opinion, because she said that they compared the book to Hitchcock and Highsmith and Gillian Flynn and The Girl on the Train, all of these books that are your traditional sort of heist mystery books.
Right.
And this is something much deeper than that. And so readers coming to it expecting that were disappointed because, you know, they got something harder,
harder,
more psychologically compelling, but maybe they weren't looking for that. And readers will miss it. I was that started me thinking about, you know, trying to sell a book in the wrong ways and what disservice that could do. That's not your area because you're not in charge of marketing. But I didn't know if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's hard to watch your book be packaged in any way. And I think no matter how they had sort of packaged it or marketed it, it would have been it's excruciating to see, you know, any writer and any novelist especially, you put all these years and you needed all of those words and all of those pages to express this idea. You can't express it in fewer words. It took you 350 pages to express the idea. And so to see it packaged, you feel like, but wait, but it's not. But you're leaving out, but you know, there's so many buts, and it's very hard to watch. And you really do have to, I think, well, I felt like I had to just sort of throw up my hands and say, well, they must know what's best for this book. You know, they know more about selling books than I do, that's for sure. But I often feel with this novel in particular, like I presented it like, okay, this is a vanilla ice cream with fudge ripple and nuts. And they're like, that's too many words. We need to just pick one. But it's a really complicated novel, all the novels that interest me can't really be said to be one flavor. We would need a lot more flavors to describe them. So I wish there were more room for that in book marketing in general, but it seems like so many books get reduced to, well, it's either chocolate or vanilla or it's butter pecan, but you can't say it's all three.
Yeah.
And I'm saying it's all three. It really is.
Because it really is, yeah. Very frustrating. We're drawing down on our time, but I wanted to quickly touch on accessing characters who are inaccessible, minor characters. You had said that there was one character you were having a hard time getting into, and once you smelled him, and I love this because I think it's so true, once you caught his fragrance, you could understand him.
And yeah,
I wanted to bring that up to listeners who are struggling with learning about their characters and all the ways you can get into people.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many ways that a character can reveal himself to you or herself to you. So totally unexpected. One character I had to sort of rewrite when I saw a pair of earrings in a shop somewhere, and I realized that I'd sort of gotten her wrong because these were the earrings she would wear, and that meant B, C, D, E, F about her. But all the character that I had to smell is so secretive. He's such a secretive character, and he's so alluring and mysterious. And I was so drawn to him, and yet I couldn't really say what I was drawn to because I couldn't get there, couldn't get to him. And at the time, I was becoming really interested in perfume. and I was reading these memoirs of perfumers and learning about people who are sort of maniacs about scent. And I was in a duty-free shop killing time before a flight, and I smelled this fragrance that wasn't quite him, but I could imagine it on a dirty jacket, like a dirty gamey jacket that had not been washed in a long time, that had been around a lot of stale cigarettes and a lot of campfires, with this sort of scent that I was smelling. And it just hit me like a lightning bolt. Oh, my gosh, that's what he smells like. And once I know that that's what he smells like, it's like I know him whether he wants me to or not. I've been given this kind of intimacy that now cannot be taken away. What's more intimate than knowing what someone smells like?
Right.
And then I just felt a new kind of confidence. Like, oh, I can get in anywhere now. I've got this golden ticket.
I love it. That's really great. I have about 8 other questions, but we're running out of time. Is there any last-minute advice that we haven't touched on that you think is really important that you would give to writers?
When you get stuck, don't beat yourself up. Just read.
That's good.
Just read until, that's what I always do, and I really believe in it. But you can't beat yourself up. You just have to go read, which is what you love to do and why you wanted to write in the first place, until something shakes loose. Because for writers, reading is what makes us examine the world and makes us want to examine it for ourselves. And so I think that's really the only thing that can kind of shake everything loose for me.
Yeah.
And you just have to wait, and it will happen.
I was at a literary conference in Long Beach this weekend, and two things about getting stuck came out from that. One woman, Amy Bender, has a font, mm-hmm. font file, and when she gets stuck, she goes into her font file, and she chooses a font, you know, like from Word.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then she has to write in the voice of the font. And
oh, that's funny.
She wrote this whole novel about a German man because the font looked like German and he was like a Nazi, but not during Nazi times or something. I was like, oh, that's great. And the other one was Library Roulette, where this woman would go into the library, and you're not allowed to go into the fiction section or the poetry mm-hmm. section, but you go into nonfiction sections and then you start connecting ideas together from nonfiction
yeah.
books you read. So.
I like that a lot. And, you know, I do something similar, it's not the same, but I do something with fonts too, which is when I'm being too self-critical and beating myself up because I just think everything that I'm writing is stupid. I highlight everything and put it in a really stupid font, like Curls or something, where it just like looks stupid on the page. And then it gives you this kind of freedom, like, oh yeah, this is really dumb, but I'm going to keep going and it's fine because it's in Curls and nothing matters anymore. And that's how I sort of get through those periods of terrible self-criticism. And then, you know, when I'm safe again, I can change it all back to Times New Roman.
Yeah, that's a great idea. It's sort of like the free writing idea where you're not allowed to use punctuation or stop.
Right, you know, the same idea. Yeah.
It's tricking your brain to stop editing itself way too early, right?
Yeah,
that's what it is.
Yeah.
That's
you just got to keep going.
Keep going.
Whatever it takes.
Keep going. Rebecca Sherm, this was such a pleasure. Thank you so much. Oh, tell us quickly where we can find you online.
Oh, you can go to my website, which is RebeccaSherm.com, and I try to keep it updated with events. And then also I'm on Twitter, Shay Sherm, CHEZSCHERM, like at the House of Sherm.
Sounds fantastic. Thank you so much for taking the time, Rebecca.
Thank you.
That was Rebecca Sherm. The book is Unbecoming. That's all the time we have for today. Stay with us. Roots and Rhythms is coming up next. Reggae Teddy is coming up next. And stay with us. Next week we will be on, as always, 9 o'clock a.m., Writers on Writing. Thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.